Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, November 1st, 2019. An international aid agency demands the release of two people abducted in South Sudan.
We have suspended our operations in five of those border areas until we can get clarity on the security situation.
And the SPLM-IO says South Sudan should once again delay forming a unity government because of unresolved issues.
There's a need to give room for this.
There is a need to give room for these issues to be resolved.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The International Organization for Migration is renewing its call for the immediate, unconditional release of a female volunteer and a four-year-old child abducted by armed men Sunday in South Sudan. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The woman and child were abducted during a gun battle that broke out between two armed groups in South Sudan's central Equatoria region. Three IOM humanitarian workers, two men and one woman, were killed in the crossfire. Spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Paul Dillon, says the whereabouts of his kidnapped colleague and the child, who is the son of the slain woman, remain unknown. He adds all efforts are being made to secure their release and identify the abductors. The place where Sunday's tragic events occurred, Isebi in Morobo County, is located on the border between South Sudan and Ebola-affected northeastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Dillon says the IOM staffers were working in the border area's Ebola screening point to track the spread of the deadly disease. He tells VOA the abduction has worrying implications.
We have suspended our operations in five of those border areas until we can get clarity on the security situation and the commitment from all actors in that area that the safety and security of our staff will be safeguarded.
Dillon says the IOM's Ebola monitoring is critical to prevent the spread of the disease into South Sudan and elsewhere. He says humanitarian workers are on the front line of the response and adds the operation will resume as soon as his agency gets necessary security assurances. Ebola was declared in the DRC's conflict-ridden North Kivu and Ituri provinces on August 1, 2018. The World Health Organization's latest report puts the number of cases of the deadly disease at 3,269, including 2,182 deaths. That is an overall fatality rate of 67%. South Sudan is one of nine neighboring countries at high risk for an Ebola outbreak. The WHO says crucial preventive measures are being taken to reduce the chance it could spread. The IOM began operations in southern Sudan in early 2005 and has continued its assistance programs since that country's independence in July 2011. Spokesman Dillon says the IOM takes its humanitarian mission seriously. But he notes its work can only be effective if the safety of its staff is ensured. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The SPLM in opposition says it agrees the pre-transitional period should be extended for another 6 months. The opposition party spokesperson says the parties have failed to resolve outstanding issues, including security arrangements and the number of states and their boundaries. But a government spokesman says the SPLM-IO is the party standing in the way of resolving those issues. Waki Simon Mudu has the story for VOA from Juba.
SPLM-IO senior member Pok Both Baluang says the environment is not good for forming a unity government in less than 2 weeks.
There's a need to give room for this.
There is a need to give room for these issues to be resolved. That is why we have decided that a 6 month extension will be enough if the international community can put pressure on the signatory parties, particularly the government, and hold accountable any obstructors on the process of the peace implementation.
President Salva Kiir said this week he expects his ruling SPLM party and the opposition parties that signed the peace deal to form a unity government on time. Baluang called Kiir's statement a mockery considering the status of the deal's implementation at the moment. He says although the parties have completed some training of forces and the ceasefire is largely holding, many other things remain unfinished, such as unifying all forces to create a national army and a national police service.
For these forces to be united and trained and redeployed, it needs time. And this has not happened yet. Now the major city should be demilitarized, and this is not being implemented yet. There have been the medium and long arm artilleries that have not been collected yet.
In addition, Baluang says the government has yet to release the entire $100 million it pledged to fund the implementation of security arrangements. Gabriel Changson Chang, who represents the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, or SSOA, in the National Transitional Committee, said recently that the government released $48 million of the $100 million it pledged. Baluang criticized the Kiir administration for lacking the political will to implement the deal. Information Minister and government spokesman Michael Makwe acknowledges there have been delays in resolving the outstanding issues ahead of forming a unity government, but he says that is because of the SPLM-IO.
It is very clear now that their intention is to frustrate all the efforts, and we reach there without agreeing on anything so that they justify their reason.
Makwe says all the necessary arrangements required ahead of the formation of the unity government are in place, and rebel leader Riek Machar can safely return to Juba.
For his personal security, the agreement gives him that right of asking the protection of a third party. And this is what we are telling him. If you are fearing, then you have the right to ask the protection of a third party up to that time when the VIP protection unit is trained and graduated, after which this foreign force will go away.
Since then, several face-to-face meetings between President Kiir and Machar have failed to resolve the outstanding issues. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudan says it will resume pumping oil in a field shut down nearly 5 years after the fighting began. South Sudan's petroleum minister says the Kiir administration expects to boost oil production levels from 178,000 barrels a day to about 250,000 barrels a day in 2020. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
Petroleum Minister Awo Daniel Chuang says Block 5A in the Tarjas oil field, which had been run by Sudan's Sud Petroleum Operating Company, will officially resume oil production this month.
We have reached an agreement, and it was a breakthrough, because the production in Block 5A, even before the crisis, we used to have like only 5,000 barrels a day production, but this time we're going to start with 16,000, which may even reach 20 or 25,000 in the next 2 years. And of course, we will be targeting around 40,000 barrels a day in that block.
Chuang says the block was shut down in 2016 as Khartoum developed logistical and technical problems in its pipeline production.
The quality of crude oil that we produced from Block 5A was causing a problem to the Khartoum refinery because, you know, as it moves from South Sudan to Sudan, a portion of it is always diverted into Khartoum refinery. That causes some difficulties in the design of the refinery because it doesn't accommodate that quality of crude oil. That's why we're being capped and we are not able to realize the full potential of this block.
The South Sudan government announced during this week's oil and power conference that it will issue a number of licenses in the first quarter of 2020 for more than 13 blocks of oil fields after a round of bidding by international companies. South Africa's Strategic Fuel Fund, which signed an exploration and production agreement in May with the government, announced it will launch an aerial survey campaign of Block B2 in December. Egypt's state-owned oil company Egyptian National Petroleum Corporation signed a memorandum of understanding with the government regarding regional cooperation in the fields of downstream oil and gas. Downstream in the oil industry involves processing, transporting and selling refined products made from crude oil. Some of the key businesses in the downstream include oil refining, supply and trading, product marketing and retailing. Before the conflict broke out in late 2013, South Sudan was producing 350,000 barrels per day. Chuang says it will be difficult to reach that level again. Guillaume Don, Chief Executive Officer for Africa Oil and Power, says seeing South Sudan resuming its oil production is encouraging. Don says he agrees with civil society activists that investors coming to South Sudan should give back to the South Sudanese people in terms of helping to develop infrastructure and provide basic services.
Invest in new infrastructure, in roads. Invest in roads, in bridges, in schools, in power generation facilities, in refineries.
Chinese National Petroleum Company, the Indian Oil and Natural Gas Corporation, FIDES, Petronas of Malaysia, Dar Petroleum Operating Company, and the South Sudan Nile Petroleum are the major oil companies operating in South Sudan. According to investigative reports by the Enough Project and the New Global Witness, some of those same companies bankrolled military forces that burned down entire villages and carried out other atrocities across South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A group of people living with disabilities have petitioned the Ministry of Justice to reverse an earlier decision to refuse to employ a visually impaired man who passed his job interview last month. The undersecretary in the Ministry of Labor says the Labor Act forbids any institution from discriminating against citizens based on race or disability. Winnie Torino has more for VOA from Juba.
Dozens of people with disabilities marched to the Justice Ministry on Wednesday to petition the Justice Minister to ensure equal employment opportunities for all. 30-year-old Maud Louise Alier, who graduated with a law degree from the University of Juba last year, says he applied for an assistant legal counsellor's opening in the Justice Ministry and was on the short list for the position after having done well in both the written and oral interviews in September. Alia says days later, his name was removed from the list because he is visually impaired.
I was surprised to be told that you are a lawyer, but your legal competence does not qualify you because you have disability. And to me, this was a very shocking process, and I think it is a wrong process, particularly given that the ministry is in the position to give legal advice to other governmental institutions on the matter, and if the issue of employment of persons with disabilities become the subject of discussion, I am concerned whether the ministry will be able to provide proper legal advice on the matter.
Alia says if the Justice Ministry had rejected him because he was not qualified for the job, it would be understandable. But being rejected for having a disability is illegal. James Mayen, Undersecretary in the Justice Ministry, says in the past, the Justice Ministry employed people with disabilities, but they were not able to work in the ministry building, so they were sent home. Mayen says they still got paid. He says, unfortunately, the ministry does not have facilities for people with disabilities. He admits that Alier placed ninth out of more than 40 candidates for the councillor's job.
We came to realize that there is somebody disabled among the people that has been undergoing interviews. And last, when we knew it, we consult ourselves at the management of the ministry, and we said that there is no facilities.
Mayen says Alier may require a car, a specially outfitted office, toilet or reading gadgets, things the Justice Ministry cannot provide. Alia says that is not true.
What they could have done is that they could have been asked first, what will be the reasonable environment for you? Because when we look at the when we look at the concept of what is reasonable, then a person has to be asked. But now I was even denied the right to be heard.
Robert Ladue, chairperson of the South Sudan Association of the Visually Impaired, says he was disappointed with the way the Justice Minister handled the hiring process and the way the Undersecretary dismissed his group's concerns, telling the petitioners his boss had little time to meet with them.
So we continue to appeal again so that they can reverse their decision, so that they can come out with an inclusive policy for the employment of any person or person with disabilities without any discrimination. We also, in this juncture, I like to appeal that the Republic, the government of the Republic of South Sudan, is to ratify the UN Convention, which guarantee the rights of persons with disabilities. And this, if it is ratified, I think such kind of negative attitude will not exist in our country.
Mary Hilary Wani, Undersecretary in the Ministry of Labour, says the Labour Act 2017 clearly states that discrimination includes any distinction, discrimination or preference with effect of nullifying or impairing the equality of opportunity or treatment in employment based on race, tribe, nationality, sex, age, religion or disabilities.
Nobody should be discriminated because of disability. And in fact, this being a government institution, it is for the government first to take the act seriously and for them to comply with it.
Wani says if facilities do not accommodate people with disabilities, they should be made to come into compliance. Alia says if the Justice Ministry fails to resolve his case, the association will file a lawsuit at the Supreme Court, which is mandated to uphold the Bill of Rights under the Constitution of South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
Tune to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. An Ethiopian government official says more than 70 people were killed in last week's bloodshed. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you like your natural hair, or do you use artificial hair or straighteners?
What makes me to use artificial hair is that my hair doesn't grow very fast. So I want to have that long hair also to look like others, you know.
I can't use artificial because it is not what I've made up of. So I'm made up of my natural hair, so there's no way of copying what I don't have.
Well, right now I'm carrying artificial hair, but then I love my natural hair. I think I look better with my natural hair, but then, you know, once in a while you have to change the look, and yeah, that's why I wear artificial hair.
I think I like my natural hair like this, though it's a little bit of a style, a gentle style is what I normally do.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Prime Minister of Ethiopia's spokesperson, Beline Seyoum, said on Thursday that up to 78 people were killed and 400 others were arrested in connection with last week's violence. VOA's Salem Solomon has more on the story.
As many as 78 people have been killed in ethnically motivated clashes in the Oromia region, Harari region, and the city of Dredawa in the past week, the Ethiopian government confirmed Thursday. Meanwhile, the activist at the center of the dispute told VOA that the situation seems to have become calmer. The violence began on October 23rd after Oromo activist Jawar Mohammed alleged that security forces were plotting an attack against him. The announcement prompted protests by his supporters. Violent clashes occurred between protesters, security forces, and members of other ethnic groups. Speaking to reporters, Beleni Siyum, spokeswoman for Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, described the events of the past week as having claimed the lives of up to 78 civilians.
No life is taken for granted, and we don't take any lives for granted as well. So I think it's also important to state that their lives also rest in peace. As a nation, these kind of incidents have a tendency to rattle many people, but at the same time, it's through these kind of incidents as well where we get to really evaluate how we respond and react to certain issues as well.
Beleni said 409 people have been arrested in connection with the attacks. Referring to the violence as senseless acts, she called for dialogue rather than violence. Abiy has allowed greater freedoms for political speech and nonviolent protests in the country since coming to power in April 2018.
So many spaces have opened up politically for people, for political parties, for individuals to engage in a meaningful way.
Beleni said the violence threatens this new openness in the country.
It's really working against Ethiopia and working specifically against Ethiopians, all that people have labored for as well.
Jawar told VOA by Skype on Saturday that the situation seemed to be quieting down.
All reports we have indicate calm has returned to almost all cities. Almost all the opposition leaders, elders, clergymen and myself appeal for people to remain calm, to return home, to open roads and be patient. So people quickly responded by disbanding protesters, removing roadblocks and returning to their home, to their normal life. So normal business activity has resumed.
With Iskender Fereo, I'm Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
The judiciaries in African Union member states have been castigated for frustrating electoral appeals by opposition candidates. During the Fourth African Judicial Dialogue in Kampala, the judiciary was criticized for placing an excessive burden on petitioners to provide evidence of electoral violations beyond reasonable doubt, which usually is impossible for opposition candidates. VOA's Catherine Nambi has this report for VOA from Kampala.
One of the incidents singled out by human rights experts is the 2011 electoral petition in Uganda's Supreme Court, where the doctrine of lack of substantial evidence was used to overrule the opposition argument that the elections were marred by numerous irregularities. Felix Odhiambo is the executive director of the Electoral Law and Governance Institute of Africa. He discussed how the situation weakens the fairness of the electoral process.
In the case of Kizza Besigye versus Yoweri Kaguta Museveni at 2006, the Supreme Court of Uganda judges found unanimously that there was election was vitiated by disenfranchisement of voters by unlawfully deleting their names of voters, the register, wrongful counting and tabulation of results, bribery, among others. But yet the court found that the substantial illegality that existed in that case did not affect the results.
He also cited the 2017 Kenyan presidential rerun and the Zambian elections, where incumbent presidents made thinly veiled threats against the judiciary over the electoral process.
Soon after the invalidation of the Kenyan presidential election, the president of the republic went on campaign rallies and warned the Supreme Court that we shall revisit. Thereafter, the president of Zambia, just before the Zambian election, advised the judiciary of Zambia not to follow the misguided example of the Kenyan judiciary.
He says African leaders have put a high priority on influencing the electoral sector because most of them don't want to leave power. Adam Kasi Abebe is the African Union advisor on governance and democracy in Africa. He has asked the judiciary to pay adequate attention to disposing of electoral disputes since most of these are human rights disputes by default.
And there has been consistent challenge to the validity of that constitutional provision. But the court has consistently affirmed that it was acceptable, that it was not against the constitution. This needs to change. This undermines fundamental rights. They use the right to political participation.
According to the experts, the controversy surrounding solving of electoral disputes by judiciaries in Africa has cast doubt on the possibility of free and fair elections on the continent and frustrates the confidence of voters who try to use the courts to resolve electoral disputes. They say this is why some elections end up in electoral violence and bloodshed or the use of guns to change power. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Rwanda's government is getting behind the carbon neutral movement by promoting electric cars and motorcycles. German automaker Volkswagen is demonstrating electric vehicles in Kigali, while a local company has begun selling electric bikes. But will the vehicles work in a city with a dense population and poor road system? Ruud Elmendorp went to Kigali to try and find out answers.
We're on the parking lot of the Kigali International Convention Center. Rwandan Prime Minister Edouard Ngirente steps in a Volkswagen electric car and maneuvers it around with no problems, like it was his own. And this is the official launch of a pilot program by Volkswagen. The company is putting 4 electric cars on the road for Kigali residents to try out through the Uber-like Move service. And if all goes well, the automaker will roll out another 50 electric cars to be powered by 15 charging stations. Ngirente says electric cars will be a step forward in Rwanda's drive to become less dependent on carbon-emitting fossil fuels.
Rwandans are becoming increasingly aware that protecting the environment is a top priority.
Arrival of the e-cars follows the introduction of electric motorcycles in Rwanda. Because of a poor road system and dense population, 70% of Kigali residents rely on motorbikes to get around. Kigali-based Ampersand is one of the companies hoping to see the public switch to electric-powered bikes. They look cool with a classy design and are manufactured partly in India, partly in Rwanda. The cost, around $1,000. Ampersand CEO Josh Wolf says that these motorcycles fulfill a need.
The motorcycles are simply cheaper to acquire and cheaper to operate, but actually have more power and more performance than the current petrol motorcycles used.
The e-bikes use a battery that lasts for about 75 kilometers of driving. Despite the limitations, Emmanuel Dayambaza says he's happy. He says he loves the electric bike because it's good. It requires little maintenance, and he says he makes more money than with a fuel motorbike. Battery life is one of the challenges for Ampersand. They're working on increasing the capacity and having more than the current 2 charging stations. The Ministry of Infrastructure is monitoring the progress with the e-bikes. If found suitable, it will start promoting them, says Ministry official Alfred Biriangiro.
After the realizing that electric motorcycle can be used on our terrain, which is a hilly terrain, we just sensitize people on advantages of using electric bikes and electric motorcycles.
Ampersand hopes to have 500 e-bikes on the road next year. But they might feel competition from the electric cars, according to Volkswagen Sub-Saharan Africa CEO Thomas Schaefer.
People are tired of sitting on the back of a motorbike and having a bad helmet here, and it rains, and the buses are sometimes full, so the take-up is amazing.
While for now motorcycles remain king of the road in Rwanda, e-cars and e-bikes are gaining ground and may lead the country to an electric, carbon-neutral future. Ruud Elmendorp for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Breathe.
We've been listening to the legendary Bob Marley with the song Get Up, Stand Up. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Thanks for being here. Have a safe weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Most people think great God will come from the sky, take away everything and make everybody feel high. But did you know?